Hello and welcome to Radio Dialect. The show is coming to you from Queen Square Studio, Bristol, and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to you in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and those that are accessing the show across the world by the internet. Our studio guests this week are Chera Daltrey. Chera is going to talk about her journey on the Trans-Siberian Express and living with the Mongolian people. Features are as usual from Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Malcolm Greaves gives us another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. I'm Lisa Braden, and now welcome now to Chera Daltrey. So you're going to talk about your experiences on the Trans-Siberian Express.
Right. Well, I went there at the end of the 60s, starting the 90s, on the Trans-Siberian. I'm sure lots of other people have been there since. But when I went, not many Europeans had been on it. And one has to fly to Moscow and then get on a train that takes 7 nights and 7 days to get to China. And I went there, and I went through Outer Mongolia. There's Inner Mongolia and Outer Mongolia, and the train goes through Outer Mongolia. Sorry. And 2 years after, I decided to fly to Ulaanbaatar, which is their capital, and go and see Mongolia for myself. And I went for the children's horse race, and which was in July, and to see the country. And then I lived with some nomads in the desert with them. And that's how I knew a little about Mongolia. And Mongolia has more horses than people. And so there's thousands of horses around, some camels. And the Mongolians themselves make their alcoholic drink from mare's milk, which they pound 24 hours a day for 8 days. And then it becomes alcoholic, their alcoholic drink. And even the children get up in the middle of the night and they're pounding and pounding and pounding. So one doesn't get very much sleep with them. And But they're very, very kind. And the lady of the Goethe that I was staying in, she very kindly, though she didn't know it, but she got some muslin and put the water from the river through the muslin to make me any drinks. She sort of knew somehow that I might get ill or something. And the children go to boarding school because they are nomads, so they move around a lot. In fact, we had a job, or the Mongolians had a job, from the airport finding where I was staying. It took quite a while. And it's the same with the children. They've moved on, so they have to stay in boarding schools in term time in the capital. Excuse me. And, oops, sorry, those were my sticks.
Carry on.
And anyway, they are the most beautiful, kindest people. They really are. And they all sleep together, of course. You don't have your own bedrooms. And you all sleep. And the grandfather used to sleep on the floor where I was sleeping to protect me. This old man, but I didn't know whether he was protecting me or anything else, actually.
Well, that sounds a bit dubious. Carry on.
And there was no water to wash. They just gave you the equivalent of our little mugs to brush your teeth. And that's all the water they had, you see, then. Mm-hmm. And so you didn't wash. And you just woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning and they cooked for you. everybody. And they went and got wild animals to eat. And it was a completely and utterly different life than I'd ever experienced. And but I did find them. Whether they are now, I don't know, because they've found oil now in the desert, and I'm sure they've changed a lot. And they were just getting then, mobile phones. So it was so funny seeing the men galloping around and then stopping and using their mobile phone. and of course, they have their children in front of them on the horse, or and at the back if they've got two or three or whatever. And but they're great, great horse people, the men. Not the women. I never saw a woman on a horse.
Really?
No. It's most extraordinary. And the women, I think, a bit like Arab women, if one's allowed to say that, who...
Knew their place.
Knew their place, yes. They had to stay in and do the cooking and the cleaning as such and look after the animals and milk the cows and the goats. They milked the goats too. And they used to roam around in the daytime. And they knew when it was time because the cows were wanting to be milked. And they used to come, they used to appear from nowhere. And then the goats would start to cry. Well, I called it crying. And I used to think, why are they leaving them? No, they were waiting for the cows. And then they all came down together, and they were all milked together, all by the women. And now, would you like to ask me any questions?
How long ago did you go to Mongolia?
The end of the 60s, 1970.
So quite a while ago.
Yes, it is now. I'm sure it's changed a lot now, but that's how it was when I was there.
And how has it influenced your life since then?
Well, it hasn't influenced my life because I haven't met any Mongolians here.
But you have fantastic experiences and life memories from that time.
Oh, yes, and from China and places, and I'm sure you have too from China. And, yes, I have, and Russia. I was there when it was communist. And yes, I have many memories of different countries.
Is there one poignant memory that sticks out for you that you'd like to share with us, or not particularly?
Well, not particularly, because I think every country is different and it has its moments, doesn't it? You know, and I remember sitting. I remember being in a Moscow hotel when it was communist. Well, it still is communist, but really communist. And these women sat on each floor and they had a book and they wrote down when you were going out and they wrote down when you were coming back. And also
quite regulated.
Oh, yes. And I did have a lover who was a Viennese entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. And he took me to the Russians in Bulgaria. And I was followed to the loo by the KGB.
Really?
Yes. And then when I came out, they wanted to know if I had any English money on me.
Fascinating. Well, thank you, Cherry Daltrey, for talking to us about Mongolia. And thank you very much for your time this evening.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you.
California Trojans. I'm so glad they beat the hell out of Michigan. I'm very glad.
listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Or go onto our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Over now to Tony Gosling's for this week's feature on Fall. The Alternative View conferences began in Totnes, Devon in 2008. The aim is to bring together speakers from all over the world to talk about some of the biggest challenges of our day. According to the organisers of Britain's newspapers and broadcasters, they're very good at avoiding difficult questions such as the power of international organised crime and whether the war on terror and even the financial crisis might have been engineered. The conferences are the brainchild of Ian Crane, and the weekend of talks began on Friday the 13th of November. Dialect's Tony Gosling began by talking to Ian about the swine flu pandemic.
My name's Ian Crane. I'm actually going to be joining a few dots. I'm going to be taking a deeper look at the bird flu issue as it relates to swine flu, as it has evolved into a global pandemic, as it evolves into what looks like being a mass vaccination program, and is also now being discussed in the US and in some European countries as mandatory vaccination. And this really, really concerns me, but as particularly as Baxter have been involved in the inadvertent release of contaminated vaccines earlier this year, which was fortunately picked up by a Czech lab technician before.
Who are Baxter?
Baxter is effectively one of the world's largest vaccine manufacturers. They have plants in most of the major nations around the world. And in fact, quite coincidentally, or perhaps not, I mean, the current swine flu outbreak originated just a few miles away from Baxter's plant in Mexico. So however you look at the current swine flu pandemic, as you start to research it, you cannot avoid keep coming back to Baxter.
Now, the thing is, we've had these pandemics in the past, in Victorian times, for example, and around about the time of the First World War. So why is it that you think this time that it in some way is being orchestrated, or that we can't trust that it is an ordinary natural pandemic?
Well, I think let's assume it's a natural pandemic for the sake of it. I mean, let's assume even that the inadvertent release of whatever came out of Baxter's has caused it, but you know, as it progresses, it's natural. The concern for me is the reaction. I mean, people die from flu every year. I mean, we heard from one of your correspondents on your program that, you know, 200,000 people die every year in Europe from normal flu. You know, and it's a massive killer, but we don't get upset about that. I mean, I don't mean that as I say in the sort of literal terms, but you know, it's part.
It doesn't make a big media fuss a big story, because this is happening fairly regularly that people are dying of flu.
Exactly. I mean, it's one of those illnesses that comes around every year. It attacks people apparently at random. Obviously, if people's health is already below par, then they are potentially more vulnerable. And it shouldn't be any surprise to us that, you know, all the people, or the vast majority of people who have allegedly died from bird flu in this country, swine flu in this country so far, that there is always the tagline that says, but they had other underlying health issues. So if the body is already weak, it's like pneumonia. I mean, pneumonia is not potentially a killer, but if your body is already, your physical form is already depleted, then pneumonia certainly turns into a killer. So if this pandemic was allowed to, shall I say, play itself out, then there's no question. I mean, we would inevitably see a number of deaths. But my concern is, if we look at what happened in 1918, we look at what happened in 1976, and I draw on the work of Eleonora McBean here from her excellent book published in 1977 called Vaccination Condemned. And she actually produces the evidence to show that in both 1918 and 1996, you know, people were actually killed because of the vaccine. And if they weren't killed, then they developed health issues. that could be traced back directly to the vaccines. I mean, one of the most significant after effects of the 1976 vaccination campaign in the US was a phenomenal rise in Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a disease that an illness that impacts on the nervous system. And it's directly traceable to the vaccine. I mean, there is absolutely no doubt about that.
These vaccines now are manufactured in the laboratory, aren't they? Whereas the original vaccines, like the one used by Edward Jenner to vaccinate against smallpox, were natural diseases, which were similar to the smallpox vaccine.
And look at what's happened recently. You know, vaccine, introducing anything into a healthy human body is a risk. I mean, that's why we have a lot of problems with the vaccination program for children. I mean, we're putting 26 vaccinations into children before they go to school, and then we wonder why there's a growth in things like autism. Of course, the medical profession wants to try and distance itself from this and says, "Oh no, there's no evidence to say that it is directly linked." But there's a hell of a lot of evidence to say that it might be, and if the fact that it might be should be sufficient in itself to warrant, much deeper investigation, but nobody wants to go there. But here we are in a situation where we're having fed to us in the media that the salvation against swine flu is going to be the vaccine that is currently being developed by Baxter. Now, vaccines generally are thoroughly tested. And I talked in a previous show I did with you, Tony, about Novartis, who developed a flu vaccine. They managed to find a private medical company in Poland who tested it on 200 homeless people, and the deaths that came out of that program were horrendous. And in fact, the doctors and nurses were actually charged with murder. Now, what we've got here is a situation where the pandemic is being talked up as such a phenomenal threat that the British government are now talking about approving the vaccine that Baxter put onto the market after 5 days. I mean, this is just incredible.
But I mean, it's all very well to criticise the media, but a lot of this information is coming from official bodies such as the government's chief medical officer and also the World Health Organization.
Well, this is true. I mean, and I know you've explained this to me before, that in a lot of cases the media are simply the mouthpiece of the government department. They're fed the information. And they are not expected to research it or to question it. They are expected to regurgitate it in whatever format that it comes out. Now, this is very unhealthy. And this is why, for me, it's extremely important that we try and encourage people to make an informed decision. And today we have opportunities like never before, because people can just sit down at a computer. They can just go to Google or any other search engine, and they can spend a few hours and they can see both sides of the story, if you like, and make their own decision.
But it is ridiculous, isn't it, to have, tens of millions of people across the country all going on the internet to make their own decision, when really what we really need is to have a good government spokesman, an honest government official, telling us the truth.
Exactly. Who's not in the pocket of the pharmaceutical company. I mean, it's been announced in the media today that GlaxoSmithKline, stand to make $2.1 billion out of this current campaign. Well, last year I exposed GlaxoSmithKline because they had their financial controller sitting on Ofsted when Ofsted made the decision to make the HPV vaccine available to all 13-year-old school children.
Just remind us who Ofsted are.
Ofsted is effectively the government appointed body that monitors all aspects related to education in this country. And so for the chief financial officer of GlaxoSmithKline to be sitting on this body when it's making the decision that basically the HPV vaccine for cervical cancer should be offered to all 13-year-old schoolgirls, which of course creates a phenomenal revenue stream for who else? GlaxoSmithKline.
Do you think there's similar issues that may relate to the swine flu pandemic, that is through possible issuing of Tamiflu around the country and the eventual swine flu vaccine when it arrives?
Well, I think this is something that we should be very, very concerned about. And I mean, a number of commentators, a number of researchers, some of whom, of course, are medically qualified, like Dr. Leonard Horowitz, for example, have all expressed the concern that this mass distribution of Tamiflu And people taking it for no apparent reason. I mean, not showing the symptoms. They're just taking it because there's a pandemic and they're scared because the media has made them scared. So they're taking this stuff. They're not probably following any recommended dosage. And there is serious concern that by taking the Tamiflu, it is actually reducing the body's natural immunity. And therefore, when the virus really kicks in the winter months, then they're even more susceptible.
So do you think there's an issue here as well? Because I would have thought it's much better to try and boost the body's own natural defences rather than to try and take out a virus whilst it's already in your body. Because, well, you know, that's sort of like, this is what the Tamiflu attempts to do, and it may have side effects.
Well, I think we definitely know Tamiflu has side effects. I mean, that's proven, it's documented. And what is also of concern is that for whatever reason, the British government has not seen fit to issue the same level of warning as is issued by the Food and Drug Administration in the USA. I mean, the FDA demand that all boxes of Tamiflu contain a warning that says that any teenager, any young person taking a course of Tamiflu should be monitored for unusual behaviour. And that is not on the boxes here. And evidence from Japan it shows that there have been some very serious incidents, up to and including suicide, you know, with young people who are taking Tamiflu. Now, it's the same Tamiflu they're taking. There's absolutely no difference in the ingredients. But it is a very serious issue, and we shouldn't take any medication lightly. But, I mean, let's understand. I mean, this is the whole issue I talk about when I talk about Codex Alimentarius, which is a food code. But basically, the pharmaceutical industry is not interested in our health. It is in the interests of the pharmaceutical industry to keep us in sickness, because that is the way in which they get their revenues. And they have a very interesting business model, because they work on the basis that from literally the time a life form, a human life form, is conceived until the time that human life form leaves this mortal coil through death, they're a potential revenue stream. And, you know, and we see many articles. In fact, I kept one recently from the Sun of all papers that said, you know, 1.4 million people in this country, in the UK, are addicted to prescription drugs. I mean, this is horrendous. But of course, for the pharmaceutical industry, it's like, yes, rub the hands together. And nobody, no industry was more upset at the recent death of Michael Jackson than the pharmaceutical industry, because he was apparently consuming something like 30,000 pounds worth of pharmaceuticals every month. Now, the pharmaceutical industry, of course, is responsible for the campaign against complementary and natural health. And let me express, you know, one point here. I am not for one moment suggesting there isn't a place for the pharmaceutical industry. There absolutely is. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about that. But our pharmaceutical industry in the Western world is totally out of control. And this was no better documented than a book that was published in, ironically, 1984. It's by a guy called John Braithwaite. And it's, the title of the book is Corporate Crime in the Pharmaceutical Industry. And that book, written 25 years ago, is as valid and arguably more valid today than it was then.
Dialect's Tony Gosling there, talking to Ian Crane, organiser of the Alternative View 3, a weekend of talks in Bristol to rival the rather stuffy Festival of Ideas. And AV3 is taking place in Bristol beginning on Friday the 13th of November, with tickets for the whole weekend starting at £100. And you can find the conference details on the web at www.av3.co.uk.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Now for this week's instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Greaves, a story set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. If you remember from last week, in 1922, out of the need to earn a living, Mr. John Fothergill moved with his family to Tame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. The people and customs he came across were not quite what he was expecting or used to. He wrote about his experiences in a diary.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Mrs. Troughton came with her young brother to lunch and buy wine. They are Norwegian. The brother has now come up to Cambridge. I asked her to put her name in our book, because she was beautiful. She did it. "Do you want this?" she asked, pointing to the brother. "You may not like his name very much." "Of course I like your splendid names resounding of the fjords." And down went Albert Bug. He told me the dons at his college had had a dinner, especially to decide how his name should be pronounced in Cambridge, where I think it came out as Budge. John Pilly, of unique manners and appearance, wrote hoping that we were having a prosperous Christmas. I replied that only 10 people had been here in 8 days owing to the cold and impassable roads. It was, as the French would say, a state of maroon glacé. 8 big cars thick in snow were left in the garage over Christmas, and 10 days later their owners returned to take them away with the same snow on them that they had come with. It makes me think of the letters that we and other similarly affected trades have written to our creditors promising cheques after Christmas. And yet, prosperity is a bad word. It smacks of grabbing from others. 1928. "Are these biscuits a homemade effort? I like them so much," said a luncher, with the dish empty and his mouth full. I told him they were not an effort, but an achievement, and I might have added that his was both. Some hunting folk. One came to lunch on Sunday looking very much a sportsman, having just become joint master of one of the big hunts. I told him that this was one of the greatest sporting events that had happened to us here. A hunting man had epigrammatically told him that if, instead of inviting the farmers to drink his champagne, he would go and drink some of their beer, he could do what he liked with them. As for our own sporting experiences, we were told to look after the hunting men, and they'd look after us. So when hounds met outside, we put bowls of gingerbreads on the bar, and they came, men and women, and ate up the gingerbreads, and women went up to the lavatory, and as soon as the gents discovered my new lavatory in the yard, there was a thin red line to and fro. For me to have objected to these little acts of trespass would have been thought as heinous as if I had gone and eased myself in their own backyards. And once I found a dandy in the common room in his shirt sleeves, vehemently brushing a very dirty coat on a rosewood table in the middle of the room. But the yard was full of horses and red coats and yellow waistcoats and violet buttonholes, mounting and dismounting. And I used to give Rec, short for Gypsy, reconciliation. The old man with the old red coat on foot with old terriers, the double rum he'd always had. And to the hunt servants sometimes drinks and smiles, and all looked bright and busy in ye olden time. And I tried wanly to feel part of it for an hour or two, till the fanfare sounded. And in an instant the place was cleared, with 2 or 3 shillings in the till, and not a penny to the yard boy, or even a nod to me. This morning, as in bed, we heard the pleasant clatter of hoofs coming under the archway. Kate suggested that we ought to put up a notice. Hunting folk are invited to continue making use of our poor accommodation without asking, and free of all charge as hitherto. I told one of the hunting people about this arrogance and rubbish, and she said that it was an abuse and a complaint common to other districts. This is sport. It's the old game. Huntsmen, artists, priests, politicians make it their business to gull or frighten the multitude into thinking they are fine fellows, and into thinking, or pretending to think, that they themselves enjoy and have a part in the game, in order that the huntsmen and so on may have the good time they want, and use the multitude to do it with. Who but a lounger or gulled person, if he had no money or leisure, would stand around on a pouring day and watch these bright folks meeting in the marketplace? It's all very silly, this, but a lot of it tends to brutalise and make innkeepers what they often are. Yet it's absurd to be bitter about them, the unpleasant ones of them, the sponges, the hangers-on. To be on a proper horse after hounds is a revelation, a new life, and perhaps the only true one. I hunted sometimes with the East Sussex, but was unpopular, chiefly because one wet day, since they used to hang about gorse bushes so long after mangy foxes or none, I brought out an umbrella and opened it to good effect. But now, in 1930, this horseplay has entirely ceased, for us at least. Only one gentleman comes and leaves his cardboard hat-box in the hall, and his groom paces up and down the yard till evening when they go home. He never speaks to me as he changes into the other hat. I wouldn't discourage him, this little reminder of old days. I said to Mitchison that it was rum that young X, now in his father's financial office, should be a communist. And he said that G.D.H. Cole says that all the dull sons of rich coal and oil parents come to him to learn labour law, and he tells them to go home and think it over. Well, that sounds very pretty and paradoxical, and superior and idealistic, but I wonder whether G.D.H. Cole or the Labour Party or any other party would really refuse either the rich or the dull. A foul, cold, windy, wet day, begun by an hour's investigation with a police sergeant into the disappearance of a leg of mutton from the archway. Then I had to give the town a full daylight display of my running powers in chasing the biggest boy, sportingly chosen, of a gang of six, whom I saw puncturing the wheel of Lucas Scudamore's Rolls-Royce outside the door with a new galvanised nail. And after a quarter of a mile of dodging and running, I got the real culprit's name from the exhausted and frightened runner. A handsome, black-haired woman came to dinner with a rather distinguished-looking man. She'd been here before, he and his huge Daimler not. They came from London to dine at my famous inn. But when I complained that two squit undergraduates had just brought two nice girls with them, and by a trick that the parlour-maid had watched were trying to make them drunk, the man started the old argument that I couldn't pick and choose and the law compelled me, etc. I told him that it was a little ungracious of him who had liked my famous inn to argue a policy for me that would make it infamous. I've had this attitude before, and I don't understand it. In any case, this is the young man's only chance of being chaste in his life, and he ought to take it. Even as it would be difficult for me now to stop the flow of decent people that I have encouraged, so would there have been a very different picture here had I not discouraged the indecent. It would have been far more human and jolly, perhaps, but troublesome.
Thank you, Malcolm. You can hear another instalment next week. Our next feature is by Anthea Page. It's an interview with extreme sportsman and TV presenter Tim Emmett, who last week gave a lecture about his exploits at Bristol Grammar School. Here he talks about exercise and nutrition.
My name's Tim Emmett. Some of you might have seen us on Top Gear racing Jeremy Clarkson up the speed climbing at the side of the Verdon Gorge in France. And then when we got to the top, we beat him, yes. And then we jumped off. We base jumped back down to the bottom. And I've also been on the BBC with Julia Bradbury for Ultimate Rock Climb. And I've done the Range Rover advert, base jumping into a cave. I've been a professional rock climber for the last 10 years. And I do lots of talks to schools all over the country and also to businesses too.
We're going to talk about sport, children, nutrition and gadgets.
Your sport, children, nutrition and gadgets. Wow, it's very diverse. Like these days, there are, talking about gadgets, there's so many amazing gadgets that can take up our time. And there's obviously 24 hours in a day, and there's a certain amount of time that we've got to spend on work and play and gadgets and computers and things like that. And certainly now, compared to 20 years ago, There's so many, so much more distractions, some computer games, video games, that are just amazing. You know, they're so good and intriguing that it's very easy to spend an enormous amount of time sitting in front of a TV or a computer. And going climbing or doing sports is so important. Doing a little bit of exercise every day, I think, is so, so important, because otherwise, if you just sit down all the time, well, if I sit down all the time, I tend to get quite lethargic and I don't really have that much energy to do things. You know, I don't feel like I want to do exercise. But if I do a little bit of exercise every day or every other day, it just wakes me up and it makes me feel more energised. I think also with the younger generation, like, food is really key, because, again, if you go back 20 years or 30 years even, the food just wasn't available in the same way that it is now. Like, it's so easy to go and get fast food. The fast food companies, you know, like sort of McDonald's, Burger King, Kentucky Fried Chicken, they just made it unbelievably easy and convenient and cheap to buy food at the drop of the hat. And it's almost a double-edged sword, because the nutritional content of a burger is so limited, you know, to the amount of nutrients and vitamins and minerals and all that sort of thing. In fact, there's hardly anything in them at all, apart from fat and a bit of carbohydrate. So although it actually fills you up, the nutritional content is almost non-existent.
Do you think we've been too influenced by the American culture?
I don't necessarily think it's the American culture. I think it's the Western world, it's modern-day society. It's just, you know, the Americans have got there first, and we're doing it as well now. People in the Western society have just got so much going on in their lives. It's so busy, and I think that sitting down to actually eat a good meal is... I think in the modern Western society, time is so much of an essence for people. Everyone's running around at 100 miles an hour, and as a result, quite often it's eating the most convenient meal which is the easiest, you see. And quite often the most convenient is not necessarily the most nutritional. Because if you go and have, like, you know, a burger and co, things like that, it's really easy to get hold of. Invariably, it's quite cheap. But the nutritional content of that food is almost zero. And what we're seeing is that people that eat whole foods, real food, like fruit and vegetables and salads and things like that, they're getting a huge amount of nutritional content and phytonutrients. What that does is it protects them from free radicals and all the damage that can occur from things like smoke or sunlight, when you're really tired or stress. All these things produce lots and lots of free radicals in your body. And the one thing that absorbs free radicals is antioxidants. And you get antioxidants from whole food, like fruit and vegetables. So what we're seeing is that a lot of people that are basing their diet on fast food are not getting these antioxidants. And as a result, they're very susceptible to getting ill. You know, when you get a cold, you might get a cold for weeks, or they've got low energy levels. It's really interesting, actually. I've been taking a fruit and vegetable supplement called Juice Plus for the last 10 years, and that gives us 17 fruits and vegetables in my diet every day, and they're raw as well, because what a lot of people don't realise is that if you cook food, the longer you cook it for, the more you break it down. And if you cook vegetables excessively, it completely destroys the nutritional content of it. And that's the same with microwaves. It's amazing. If you put some food in a microwave, the microwave kills it. It not only kills the food, but it actually changes the molecular structure of what you've put in there, to the extent where when you actually eat it, the body, it finds it very difficult to recognise the different constituents of what you're eating. And as a result, it doesn't absorb it into the bloodstream, and it just means that if you zap your food, you're not really getting any nutrients out of it at all.
What about campfires? Going back, I was brought up with the Girl Guides and Boy Scouts, yeah, and we were taught to cook over a campfire. Not barbecues or anything like that, a campfire. Quite a skill, and it was just fantastic, yeah, being out in the open,
yeah,
cooking your food. A lot of children don't experience that anymore, yeah, do they?
I completely agree with you. I think that going out into nature, going camping and spending time in the wilderness is something that many of the people that live in cities just don't have the opportunity to do. And certainly for me, taking up rock climbing has opened up the world, actually, to spending time away from civilization and away from roads and cars and all the busyness that we're so used to dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And actually, I find that when I'm in that sort of situation, it 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 changes my view of the world. And I think that if we can give or help people to or give them the opportunity to go climbing or go camping or go and do like the Duke of Edinburgh Award, for example, it really can open up people's perception as to what what life's all about. I know that there was an article in the newspaper a few days ago that asked some of the top companies in Britain, if two people have got exactly the same qualifications, what is it that makes the company decide to take one over the other? And they had a whole list of, you know, whether you're a prefect at school or, you know, all the different extra qualifications that you've got. And the number one thing that was right at the top of the list was, if you'd done the Duke of Edinburgh Award, you'd get, that's the best possible extracurricular activity that would give you the opportunity to get the job.
What about sailing, though, as well, rock climbing? It's very much a team effort. Do companies regard that as a good thing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing with rock climbing is that someone has got to hold your rope. So there's always two people in the team, and your life is in their hands, which is, you know, quite a serious situation to be in, literally, because if you make a mistake and you don't hold the rope properly or you're not paying attention and then the other person falls off, it's your responsibility. And also with sailing and lots of other of these activities, is that it's so important to be able to work as a team and communicate with other people in the team, because if you don't do that, then it gets very disfragmented and it can often fall apart. And I think companies really want that. They want people to work as part of a team, because it you know, brings the company together and allows it to be a lot more functional and successful, I guess.
That was Timmer, extreme sportsman and TV presenter, talking to Anthea Page.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
This feature is from Gregory Leslie from the United Nations Association Cardiff, here interviewed by Anthea Page about the Pay Equality Bill and its implications for local authorities.
This is Mr. Leslie from Cardiff, United Nations Association. I've been asked to talk about the situation with regard to the strike that people probably heard about in Leeds with regard to the bins being left uncollected for the past 2 or 3 weeks, which has been caused by the refuse collectors refusing to work because they're facing substantial pay cuts because of the implementation of Pay Equality Bill, which was passed in 1997, but strangely has taken 12 years to be put into effect, and it's put into effect now at the cost of these men having their pay drastically cut.
Why have the council cut their pay?
Councils cut their pay because supposedly they're short of money, and so they thought that the way that they can afford to pay the women the same wage as the men is to reclassify the grade of these male operatives to a lower grade, so that they'll bring down the pay of the men and then bring up the pay of the women to that level, so it's more affordable to Leeds Council to do that.
How will that affect the women if the men are getting lower pay?
Well, in fact, in the long run, they'll be worse off than they would have been if, for example, it had not been implemented for 3 years. For the sake of example, that the men were getting £20,000, and so over 5 years they get £100,000. Now, if their wage is now being cut down to 15,000, and the women were getting, let's say, 13,000 is going up to 15,000. So you can do your maths. The women over 5 years are only going to get 75,000. So if it was delayed for 3 years, they'd be better off. So it's better for it not to be implemented until this local authority in Leeds can actually afford it. But the worst thing is, this is going to be the case all over the country, because all councils now have to implement this Pay Equality Act. And if they haven't got the cash, they're going to do the same thing as Leeds. And we're going to find bins uncollected everywhere. And women are going to be upset that they're really being mistreated. And the men will probably have resentment towards their women. And then maybe if their wives are doing these kind of jobs, because it's not being done in a way that everybody foresaw. It's not bringing people's pay up to the level of the male colleague.
Do you think this will cause widespread strikes in all sectors of the community?
Yes, I should think so, because in many professions, a woman is not paid the same as a man, which is completely wrong, of course. But there must be a way around it.
What's the solution then?
Well, if the union representing the men in this particular case regarding refuse collecting and the TUC in general were to approach the local government association and say, yes, we want pay equality for our women, but we want it to be at the correct level of pay. We don't want the men suddenly to have their wage reduced. So we'll be in favour of pressing the government to provide sufficient money to the local authorities so that they can afford to implement this. And if, under pressure from us and the local government association, the central government is not prepared to provide the money so that equality can be implemented, it would be far better if there was a delay of, say, 3 years until such time as local authorities can afford to fully implement this and give the men and the women the same level of pay at the correct grade and the correct salary. So either delay it for 3 years or get the TUC and the local government association together in pressing the government to provide sufficient money for it.
To finish off the show, we have a poem from Gregory Glesley called Be Nice to Your MP.
This is a poem about our wonderful MPs, who of course are back in the news again. The poem's called Be Nice to Your MP. Poor MPs, why they're the bee's knees, charging utterly reasonable fees for the very barest of necessities of everyday living. The system should be more giving. Such a sanctimonious public, why, it makes you sick, egged on by a press which fails to impress with their record of reporting, or should I say distorting. Why can't they all understand, rather than join the hostile band? MPs need a helping hand in this callous, two-faced land of moralising meddlers who would pretend to be peddlers of a new upright morality that would end finality. So, as I say, be nice to your MP.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Or go onto our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And now here's a track called Tami Pondia Fies by Azul Nanwes.
Pero quizás tú lo dudas, mas confieso la verdad, que para amarte yo nací, solo a ti y a nadie más. Que para amarte yo nací, solo a ti y a nadie más.
Just before we round up this week's show, here's a few events we've been asked to publicise coming up in the next few weeks. Viva Palestina will leave Bristol on Friday the 4th of December 2009 to join the international convoy and will arrive at the Gaza border on December the 27th, 2009, the first anniversary of the Israeli assault on Gaza. They will be taking medical supplies and basic provisions to relieve the hardship and show the people of Gaza that the world has not forgotten them. £6,000 is needed to fund the trip. Various events have been organised to raise the money. On Friday the 6th of November, between 7:30 and midnight, at Halo Cafe, 141 Gloucester Road, Bristol, there is an evening of entertainment. For further information, please ring Bob Lewis or contact him at 891@talktalk.net. And there is the Human Jukebox from South Bristol and DJ Dad appearing, and they're expecting donations on the night. A singing workshop with Palestinian musician and radio presenter Rem Kelani is on the Sunday the 22nd of November 2009 from 10 a.m. to 4:30 at the Southville Centre. Join Rem in this exciting workshop. She travels to the Middle East to record the traditional songs, preserving them for posterity. Tickets are £20 or £12.50 concessions. Discounts for early bookings are our groups. Contact Judith on 01761 451 553 or sallydean22@aol.com. That's all from Dalet Radio this week. In the studio was Cherry Daldry and features by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Malcolm Grieve read another chapter of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Studio engineers were John Peters Coleman. The producer was Anthea Page. It's goodbye from all of us and me, Lisa Braden. Goodbye for another week. Take care.